This is FSRN, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on this week's show, opponents of the Dakota Access Pipeline are cautiously optimistic after the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers puts the project on hold. The city of Portland, Oregon, approves a first-of-its-kind tax on corporations with gaping pay disparities. And it's been 10 years since the Mexican government militarized the so-called war on drugs. Now the ruling party wants to make extraordinary measures legal and permanent. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. Opponents of the Dakota Access Pipeline remain cautiously optimistic after the Army Corps of Engineers refused to grant an easement to the last bit of land necessary for developers to bore under a reservoir on the Missouri River. The announcement, which came as thousands of U.S. veterans arrived at the Ochetee Chacoan camp, was met with jubilation. During a forgiveness ceremony Monday, Wes Clark Jr., the son of former NATO military commander, U.S. General Wesley Clark Sr., took a knee and issued an apology for past crimes committed against the region's original residents, carried out or enabled by then members of the U.S. Armed Forces.
We took your land, we signed treaties that we broke, we stole minerals from your sacred hills, we blasted the faces of our presidents onto your sacred mountain, and we took still more land, and then we took your children, and then we tried to take your language, and we tried to eliminate your language that God gave you and that the Creator gave you. We didn't respect you. We polluted your earth. We've hurt you in so many ways. And we have come to say that we are sorry. We are at your service, and we beg for your forgiveness.
But the celebrations were quickly tempered by a statement from Energy Transfer Partners, the developers of the project, saying the company fully expects to complete pipeline construction without rerouting. Reports of an oil spill about 200 miles away in a tributary that feeds the Little Missouri River underscored continued concern. As the news settled in, so did a major snowstorm, bringing Arctic conditions with sub-zero temperatures to the camps where thousands of people were lodging as part of the massive resistance to the four-state, nearly $4 billion pipeline.
There's no need for the water protectors or for anybody to be putting ourselves in unsafe environments. We have a winter storm. We have cold weathers coming.
Standing Rock Sioux Chairman Dave Archambault issued a video statement in which he said the battle has now entered a new phase, one that will play out over months, and citing public safety concerns, he encouraged people to leave the camp.
There's no action that's going to take place by the company. If they violate that easement, it's going to threaten all the investors' monies. It's going to threaten the project entirely because they will never get an easement if they cross the boundary. So what we need to do is we have to be proud of what we did. We have to be honored by the victory, and it's time now. It's time to go home.
But some plan to ride out the harsh, frigid North Dakota winter to keep an eye on the now-paused pipeline construction. The company asked the D.C. District Court this week to issue an expedited ruling, allowing them to continue work on the Army Corps land, but no rulings were issued in a Friday hearing. Energy Transfer Partners claims it has lost hundreds of millions of dollars due to project delays and risks losing the contract to the very oil that they plan to route from the Bakken oil fields to an Illinois transfer hub. President-elect Donald Trump's transition team has indicated he supports the pipeline project and will review the matter once he takes office. Trump held investments in the company as recently as last year, and its CEO donated more than $1.5 million to the Trump campaign. With just 6 weeks until Inauguration Day, The president-elect is quickly naming nominees for cabinet roles and high-level administration positions. This week, he selected Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt as his pick to head the Environmental Protection Agency. Pruitt has a history of public hostility towards the EPA, questions the reality of human-caused climate change, and is closely allied with the fossil fuel industry. Trump also announced his pick for Secretary of Labor this week, Andrew Puzder, CEO of the company that owns the Hardee's and Carl's Jr. fast food chains. Puzder opposes significant increases in minimum wage and expanding the qualifications for overtime pay, and he supports rolling back the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, despite the fact that many fast food workers rely on it for access to health care. Puzder is widely reported to have earned nearly $4.5 million in 2012 alone and is another example of CEOs making millions while their workers can't afford the basics. But a new measure passed this week in Portland, Oregon, aims to rein in that disparity. FSRN's Sam Bowman reports.
The City Council of Portland, Oregon, has approved a first-of-its-kind surtax on businesses with gaping income inequality between their highest and lowest-paid workers. Companies with CEOs who make more than 100 times the salary of their lowest-earning employees will pay a 10% higher city tax rate. That percentage jumps to 25% if a chief executive earns more than 250 times the pay of workers on a company's bottom rung. Once it came up on the City Council agenda Wednesday evening, the measure passed in less than 3 minutes, with council members each giving brief statements as they voted. Here's Portland Mayor Charlie Hales speaking ahead of his vote in favor.
Big problems of our time, climate, race relations, income inequality, are being addressed by cities. It probably should be a federal priority, and I hope someday it is. But right now, it falls to cities to do creative, progressive policymaking, and that's exactly what this is.
The bill's sponsor, City Commissioner Steve Novick, said his intent was to spark a national debate on how to address rising income inequality and that he hopes other cities will take up similar measures. The tax rates are due to take effect in the coming year after the Securities and Exchange Commission begins publishing data on the ratio between CEO compensation and median worker pay. Sam Bowman, FSRN, Portland.
Nearly one in three working-age adults in the U.S. has some type of criminal record. And that legal status is a barrier for millions of job-seeking Americans who must reveal past convictions on employment applications. But states, counties, and cities around the country are adopting ordinances and laws that would ban the box, the one on job applications that asks about criminal history. FSRN's Lena Nozizwe reports that Los Angeles is one of the latest to do so, and the measure passed there takes the ban a step further than most.
Good morning. As you said, my name is Anthony Fagan. I'm 28. I'm married.
Clean cut and outfitted in a dark blue suit, soft-spoken Anthony Fagan looks like a businessman on the rise. But what's not apparent at first glance is the baggage that was weighing him down on the job market, a criminal conviction.
I've met individuals who've been haunted by past convictions, and no matter what they do or how hard they work, they just can't get a job.
That's Los Angeles City Councilman Curran Price, who represents the 9th District. Most of his constituents are Latino or African American, communities disproportionately impacted by incarceration. Price was speaking at an L.A. City Hall news conference just hours before the City Council voted to pass the Fair Chance Initiative. The law, which goes into effect January 1st, will prohibit employers from asking about past convictions until a conditional offer of employment has been made, instead of requiring that information on the initial job application.
Without the stigma of a criminal record, my hope is that job candidates will be evaluated solely by their skills, their qualifications, and their merits. Today, tens of thousands of Angelenos and their families have an opportunity to change for the better.
The movement to eliminate the criminal history checkbox question, also known as Ban the Box, has gained traction around the country. More than 150 cities and counties have already adopted versions of Fair Chance laws, and 24 states, including California, have similar measures in place for public sector employment. It's also received federal attention. The Federal Office of Personnel Management recently finalized a ban-the-box hiring rule that, for a significant amount of positions, delays inquiries about criminal histories until a job offer is on the table. Councilman Price says the Los Angeles ordinance is one of the most progressive in the country because not only does it apply to city contractors and subcontractors, the Fair Chance Initiative also applies to private businesses with 10 employees or more. Employers who don't comply will initially face warnings and then fines.
I have kids too. I want the same things you want. I want a home. I want to drive a nice car. I want to be part of this society.
Kusima Thomas is a mentor with Homeboy Industries, a nonprofit started by a Jesuit priest 3 decades ago to provide former gang members like Thomas with job opportunities. Their motto is, nothing stops a bullet like a job.
When you have to check the box, it's almost as like you just don't want to be there. You know, like you just know that I'm not going to get this job. Nobody's going to offer me this job.
Oh, every time. It's almost like you go in knowing that you're going to be denied the opportunity.
Amber Rose Howard, a college graduate who was convicted of a felony at age 18, can relate.
Sometimes it's so horrifying that you're actually hired and then you'll receive notification that the job has been recanted because they found out about your felony, which personally happened to me. So it was a job working with youth who were at risk of being incarcerated.
And this was after you graduated from college?
This was after I obtained a college degree. They hired me, went to orientation. They selected me to work with a distinct group of students. And then after they got my record history back, they took back the job offer, strictly because of the felony record from 10 years prior.
Howard is now a community organizer who helped draft LA's ordinance that she says goes a long way in providing justice for all. Howard has a response for prospective employers dealing with the fear factor.
There's no need to be afraid. Our past do not define us, and I think a lot of employers will come to learn that as they continue in this process.
Gary Bernard Williams is Big Boss's part of the process. Although he admits he struggled to recover from past drug addictions and find work after he was released from prison in 2003. He would intentionally leave the box blank and offer to discuss his past in person with prospective employers. Today, he is a Methodist minister in South Los Angeles.
My God is a God of second and third chances. And so I'm in the community in the heart of South LA. My members, a lot of my members and people in the neighborhood in which I live and work are people that need a second chance.
The Fair Chance Movement is hoping that legislation, not divine intervention, will mean that millions of others will get that second chance as well. Lena Nozizwe, FSRN, Los Angeles.
You're listening to FSRN, Free Speech, Radio News, independent, non-commercial media. To find out how you can support FSRN, visit our website, fsrn.org.
This week marks 10 years since Mexico's former president, Felipe Calderón, militarized the so-called war on drugs, first deploying troops to carry out law enforcement duties in his home state. Since then, tens of thousands of people have disappeared, more than 100,000 have been killed, and accusations of human rights abuses carried out by both organized crime groups and the country's security forces continue to mount. Now, the current president, Enrique Peña Nieto, and his party are pushing for a legal measure to grant the military even more policing and surveillance powers, stoking fears that more violence and insecurity is to come. FSRN's Clayton Kahn brings us more from Mexico City.
At a ceremony to commemorate the 106th anniversary of the Mexican Revolution, Mexico's president, top lawmakers, and ranking military brass praised the role of the country's armed forces in combating organized crime. Navy Secretary Vidal Soberan Sanz urged the population to stand behind the military, which increasingly has come under fire for alleged human rights abuses.
Es necesario que los tres poderes de la Unión.
It is necessary for the three branches of government, political parties, and society as a whole to join forces in all areas to end all that is damaging to us as a nation. That is the only way to avoid more victims.
Soberon Sen says the military supports a recent proposal made by members of the ruling Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI, that will make permanent extraordinary powers granted to the armed forces. Called the Interior Security Law, the legislation seeks to further erase the legal line between military and civilian law enforcement duties.
Nos unimos a la intención de formular un marco jurídico.
We support the proposal to formulate a legal framework that will prevent this state of uncertainty in which soldiers, pilots, and sailors have remained, that there be legal certainty to our actions and the legal vacuum ruled out.
Human rights defenders criticized the proposal, calling it a means to normalize a state of exception declared 10 years ago when former President Felipe Calderón deployed the military throughout the country for the stated purpose of fighting organized crime. Former head of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, Emilio Álvarez y Casa, says the armed forces need to stay out of domestic law enforcement.
The army, a soldier, is being trained in the extreme use of force, how to kill an enemy. That's why they are for. We need them for national security. And we pay for armies because of that. But it's not a policeman.
According to Article 28 of the proposed law, the military will also be granted greater surveillance powers previously deemed illegal and unconstitutional. For digital rights lawyer Gisela Perez de Acha, this would further diminish the already limited toolbox for defending human and civil rights in Mexico.
If they can already do pretty much anything, and we are going to legalize the surveillance faculties for them, online and offline, the problematic thing will be that we will not have the capabilities as citizens to push back against that. And we have more of that within against the police.
Since Calderón militarized the nation's public security strategy a decade ago, the official number of identified drug cartels has more than doubled. Meanwhile, the number of disappeared persons has risen to just under 30,000, a toll comparable to that of Argentina's dirty war. The death toll is even higher, with an estimated 186,000 fatalities according to official numbers. When confronted with those bleak statistics, officials tend to point fingers at violent criminals. But international human rights organizations have extensively documented police and military involvement in enforced disappearances and extrajudicial executions. Araceli Rodriguez, whose son was disappeared in 2009, echoes a common sentiment among victims' families.
If those whom we entrust to protect us, take care of us, investigate crimes, are not doing that, well, they should face exemplary punishment, because not one public servant has been made an example of. That is why they continue with all this foolishness. That is why they continue to associate with the narcos, and it's why they continue to disappear people.
Impunity is the rule in Mexico, even in the exceptional cases in which allegations of corruption or human rights abuses are investigated. Even when carrying out civilian police duties, the armed forces are only accountable to a military court system. Policy analyst Laura Carlson argues that legislative proposals that fall short of systemic change will be ineffective in stopping the cycle of Mexico's violence and insecurity.
Everyone pretends like the problem is just getting the right formula of who's in charge or of changing around the names of the agency or of having the United States Merida Initiative come in and do training with these people. And it has nothing to do with the technical fix. It has to do with political will. As long as the Mexican government is benefiting both on the individual level of corrupt officials and on the institutional level of structural corruption and complicity from the lucrative drug trade, we're not going to see any changes.
Although Mexican lawmakers and the country's Defense Department say passage of the Interior Security Law is a top priority, political observers predict it is unlikely to occur in the current legislative session that ends in mid-December. Yet, 10 years after the militarization of the drug war, soldiers in the streets has become the new normal in many parts of Mexico. Clayton Khan, FSRN, Mexico City.
The West African nation of Cameroon is experiencing a steep drop in wild fish stocks. Local communities that depend on coastal fisheries say foreign vessels, many of them Chinese in origin, are illegally trawling in domestic waters and depleting their catch. FSRN's Ngala Kilian Chimton reports from Limbe, Cameroon.
About a dozen women hover over charcoal cook fires, grilling freshly caught fish from the waters near Limbe, a seaside city of more than 80,000 where fisheries remain a major source of livelihood. But these days the future looks bleak for many fisherfolk who depend on wild fish stocks. With coastal fish stocks depleted, small-time fishermen are venturing further out to sea. But with small boats not designed for the open sea, it's very dangerous. Fisherman James Ogok explains.
We use a simple canoe and engine boat, and we net the Nofigo right inside the sea. These Chinese fisher people, they get all kind of machine them, all kind of BB machine them.
Conflict between industrial fishing trawlers and indigenous fleets is nothing new. That's why there are established a 3 nautical mile limit that's supposed to exclude large vessels and protect the future of the fisheries sector. Cameroon has ramped up efforts to protect its territorial waters. It announced that its navy would step up patrols. There are many Chinese companies and commercial interests in and around Limbe, and that's led to increasing tensions. Chinese fisherman Huang Chou declined to speak on tape, but he told FSRN he never fishes outside international waters. Whether or not that's true, environmentalists agree that illegal fishing is a real problem. Greenpeace Africa campaigner Ahmed Diame told FSRN that at least 5 cases of serious Chinese flagged vessels fishing inside the exclusionary zones have been reported this year. But he says while the Cameroon government talks tough, its officials often look the other way.
Corruption and lack of transparency in the management of fisheries resources is a huge challenge in West Africa. One of the consequences of this situation is that in many countries, officials and fishing companies, not only Chinese, are in collusion.
Greenpeace has long argued that outdated regulations and lack of coordination makes it easy for large fishing corporations to take advantage of weak national governments. The answer, Diame says, is to work together. But so far, that hasn't happened. Instead, Cameroon's fisheries ministry had suggested that fishermen sell their boats and invest in fish farms. Cameroon has pumped at least $25 million into developing aquaculture since 2012. This comes as foreign-owned factory trawlers continue to regularly trespass into West Africa's fishing grounds. It threatens the future of the fisheries, and with it, the region's way of life. Ngala Kilian Chimtom, FSRN, Limbe, Cameroon.
In California, work is underway to reconnect one of the state's longest rivers to the Pacific Ocean. Dams and levees built in the early 20th century have kept the San Joaquin River in the Central Valley from flowing into its natural delta year-round. But a landmark decision in federal court more than a decade ago forced state and federal agencies to partner with farmers, cities, and environmentalists to craft a way to restore the river and its wild salmon run. FSRN's Vic Bedoian explains.
Restoring the San Joaquin River is the most ambitious endeavor of its kind in the nation. Since the Fryant Dam was built in the 1940s, most of the river water captured has been used by farms and cities along the east side of the agricultural Central Valley, and the river often dries up just 50 miles downstream from the dam. The San Joaquin once had one of the largest salmon runs in the state that formed a biological chain between the Pacific Ocean and California's fertile interior. At a state fish hatchery just below Fryant Dam, biologists from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife are working hard to bring the fish back. Biologist Gerald Hattler explains how.
What we can do here is we can take a very small number of fish. We will bring them here either as eggs or juveniles. We raise them up until they're sexually mature, which is approximately 3 years, and we'll spawn them here at the facility, and then their offspring will go into the San Joaquin River.
Much of this work was sparked by a landmark 2006 settlement between the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, California resource agencies, and environmental groups that had sued to force the government to restore the river. Elizabeth Vasquez of the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation says already there's been progress.
We actually got to reconnect the river this year. It's the first time since 2011 that water's flowing from Bryant Dam all the way down the upper river to the confluence through the Merced all the way to the ocean.
It's a massive, complex undertaking. Restoring the continual river flow will impact farmers downstream who draw water from the river and aquifers to irrigate crops. And here's where there's potential conflict. In order to accommodate salmon runs, it will be necessary to build a bypass channel for fish to swim around at least one reservoir that serves farms. In other places, river channels and levees would need to be reconstructed, says Vasquez.
We have to basically build the river from the ground up. So we have to work with our neighbors, the farmers that are adjacent to the San Joaquin River that have started to farm closer to the levees that would be affected by flow going back to the river. We've got to look at the levees themselves to make sure that they're capable enough to pass our flow. And we've got to actually work with the entities taking water off of the river for their agricultural interests.
Over the past 70 years, San Joaquin River water has been critical not only to farms, but also cities up and down California's Central Valley. But enough water to restore fish habitat could mean reducing water for humans downstream by nearly a fifth. The water interests of towns and farms are represented by the Fryant Water Authority. Jason Phillips is chief executive officer. He says the project is 5 years behind schedule.
There's been incremental progress, and I think for some of the selling parties, that's a really good thing. But at this point, as I look at it, the challenges are greater than we know how to solve right now.
One of those challenges rose up in 2009 when water flows were released downriver to test the system. In the decades-long absence of a flowing river, some farmers have planted crops close by or even in the river bottom. Restored flows could damage those crops. Phillips describes what ensued.
What happened was more seepage started occurring into the adjacent farmlands than what was envisioned in the settlement itself. And because of that, the Bureau of Reclamation had to start making adjustments to the construction plans.
It will take a lot of political will to move the project forward. The overall goal remains 2029 at a projected cost of $1.6 billion. Only a fraction has been allocated and spent to date. That's not helped by opposition from local figures who don't agree with the spending priorities. Then there's the drought, which makes diverting water from farms and towns even more difficult. But river restoration advocates counter that the benefits are overlooked. These include flood control, replenished aquifers for future water supply, and recreation for the public to enjoy at the river. Already there are hopeful signs. Some 50,000 Chinook fingerlings were released into the San Joaquin last spring, and this year that number should triple with more hatcheries planned. But releasing juvenile salmon will do little for the ecosystem if they can't make it to the Pacific and back to spawn. But if they do, the San Joaquin River Restoration Program would prove itself a model for restoring dam-choked rivers elsewhere in the nation and beyond. Vic Bedoyan, FSRN, Fryant, California.
And that does it for this week's program. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.